You are now listening to Jess's Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jess's Lit. We are back with our third episode in a row. I've been going on quite a bit of a run here just to add more fill-ins because I won't be here in the month of June, and so we're getting kind of packed in the month of April. But today we will focus on the sonnets from Shakespeare again. We are doing a little series for those of you guys who are kind of just tuning in this episode for the first time. We've been doing a Shakespeare sonnet series for the past, I think, 4 or 5 episodes, or even more, actually. And so we have finally gone to sonnet 25. We'll be starting sonnets 26, and we'll try and get as much as we can done for today. I'm hoping to get through at least sonnet 30, maybe sonnet 31, but depending on how time goes, we'll see how it goes. The weather's shining as bright as ever. It is quite chilly out there, though, not going to lie, but please take advantage of the sun, because I believe we're going to get some rain sometime in the weekend. Hope it changes, but that's what I saw in the weather app today. But finals are still kind of going on their way. I have one on the 24th, and so let's hope all that goes well. Before we move on to sonnet 26, I have one song to play for you guys, and some ads, show promos, and PSAs, and so after those we will be back to sonnet 26. The first song to play here today is Need by Tess Anderson. Here we go.
Sleeping, I'm not taking care of me. I'm just wasting away, watching everybody looking like they're on a TV. Stupid is as she does. It's dumb feeling like I'm not enough. Stupid is as she doesn't. I'm so done thinking.
I'm gonna get what I need. Picture this. You're walking into your local record store and start skimming the many records until you find an album that you recognize. You pick out the album, check the track list, and maybe only recognize a couple songs. Now you have to listen to the whole album, right? Well, why not do it together? On Discali, every show runs you through an entire album and breaks down key parts and songs that make up an album's aesthetic, art, and story. I'm your host, Oliver, and join me every Friday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. in talking about all things music. Want to discover more albums, artists, record pressings, and concerts? I got you. That's every Friday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., so tune in to Discali to discover different discographies and add to the musical discourse.
If the news are getting you down or you're tired of scrolling on your phone, Massey Books is the one-stop shop for you. A 100% Indigenous-owned business that is committed to giving back to local charities, community initiatives, and organizations, Massey Books has a vast selection of rare and unique books, as well as a diverse range of books that are from underrepresented authors. You can shop online at masseybooks.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read. Are you looking to decolonize your self-care routine? Take a trip down to Sisters Sage for a variety of handmade soaps, bath fizzies, smudge sprays, and salves infused with traditional plant medicines. Sisters Sage is an award-winning local Indigenous business run by Tsimshian entrepreneur, activist, and community builder Lynn Marie Angus and her dog TJ. Passionate about crafting wellness products that are respectful of the land we live on, Sisters Sage is committed to a heart-centered approach to self-care as well as our collective healing. Located on 1312 Kingsway, you can drop by from Monday to Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. See you there.
The Vancouver Cherry Blossom Festival is running its most vibrant season yet until April 28th, 2025. This year, the festival offers an even larger and more diverse lineup of events that celebrate both the beauty of the cherry blossoms and the richness of our community and local art scene. There's something for everyone to enjoy, with many of these events being free to the public. A cultural celebration with traditional performances, arts, and culture, and delicious Japanese cuisine, created in collaboration with Japan Fair Association of Vancouver. Other supporting events include haiku invitational, workshops, tree talks and walks, and much more. The Vancouver Cherry Blossom Festival invites attendees to celebrate Vancouver's cherry tree heritage through accessible arts, culture, and nature programming in the city's parks and neighborhoods. Everything that has bound this couple is now unraveling before us. This April 17th and 18th at 7 p.m. at Left of Main, James Kudelka's Half an Hour of Our Time is a duet that is dense with incident, performed entirely in silence. James Kudelka's Half an Hour of Our Time was originally commissioned by Moon Horse Dance Theater in 2008 and performed by Claudia Moore and Dan Wild. This 30-minute duet was primarily influenced by Jean Cocteau and Francis Poulenc's one-act opera, La Voix Humaine. Among today's most versatile and innovative dance artists, Kudelka has choreographed for leading ballet companies and smaller contemporary troupes. This presentation is a rare opportunity to witness his work in an intimate setting. Visit plasticorchidfactory.ca for more information.
Welcome back to Jess is Lit. Those were some ads, show promos, and PSAs, and Need from Tess Anderson. We'll get right into Sonnet 26. Lord of my love, to whom in vassalage, thy merit hath my duty strongly knit. To thee I sent this written embassage, to witness duty, not to show my wit. Duty so great, which wit so poor as mine, may make seem bare, in wanting words to show it. But that I hope some good conceit of thine, in thy soul's thought all naked will bestow it, till whatsoever star that guides my moving points on me graciously with fair aspect, and puts apparel on my tattered loving to show me worthy of thy sweet respect. Then may I dare to boast how I do love thee, till then not show my head where thou mayst prove me. So that was Sonnet 26. We'll give this one a close read here. Lines 1 and 2. Lord of my love, to whom in vassalage thy merit hath my duty strongly knit. Now we are opened with a metaphor, positioning the beloved as a lord and himself as a vassal. And so we see that this is, it's a feudal language here, and it invokes a bond of both loyalty and submission. Vassalage implies here that both duty and reverence, and it suggests that the speaker's love is not casual, or just kind of free-flowing, and it is instead bound by obligation and honor. And the phrase, thy merit hath my duty strongly lit, kind of continues the idea of that, where the beloved's virtue, merit, compels the speaker's loyalty. And the word knit is also kind of significant, where it implies something that's tightly bound and not easily unraveled, which emphasizes a deep emotional and moral tie. We're going to move on to lines 3 and 4. To thee I send this written embassage, to witness duty, not to show my wit. And so here, the sonnet is likened to an embassage, so an old form of embassy or a diplomatic mission. And so, therefore, the poem here is a humble envoy, a formal communication sent to express some kind of loyalty, not just a brilliance, but royalty. And we could see how he explicitly denies any intent to impress with cleverness, not to show my wit, quote unquote, as he says or writes. And so this disavowal of a sense of rhetorical flair is a rhetorical move in itself. You can kind of see that. A familiar gesture, in poetry where the humility side, humility aspects, becomes a form of self elevation. So lines 5 and 6, duty so great, which wit so poor as mine, may make seem bare in wanting words to show it. There's a sense of acknowledgement here in the inadequacy of his own poetic skill, wit so poor, as we hear or read, to properly express the enormity of the duty, of his duty. His love feels rich, but the language he has to convey it feels kind of bare, quote unquote. And so here we see a paradox of poetic humility and perhaps a subtle compliment to the beloved. So that is lines 5 and 6. Moving on to lines 7 and 8. But that I hope some good conceit of thine in thy soul's thought all naked will bestow it. Now, he's hoping that the beloved's own imagination, where we read some good conceit of thine, will fill the emotional depth that the speaker's words fail to provide. And so the phrase all naked here suggests that the soul's thought is honest and unadorned. And the intimate inwardness from the words all naked is trusted to perceive the speaker's truth even when language fails. And so we see a little bit of a movement in the poem to a kind of telepathic faith in emotional connection, where the beloved will understand even if the words fall short. And so that's a lot of this poem here deals with a lot of the metaphysical, emotional, mental, telepathic aspects of the human mind and the human soul, I think. And so, which is very interesting. Lines 9 to 12. Till whatsoever star that guides my moving points on me graciously with fair aspect and puts apparel on my tattered loving to show me worthy of thy sweet respect. Now we see a metaphor again, which kind of shifts to astrology and faith. A metaphor that dealt with astrology was also mentioned in our previous sonnets as well. And so, quote unquote, the star that guides my moving, I think may refers to the beloved, or to fate more generally. And so the speaker here waits for that star to shine kindly with, quote unquote, with fair aspect and clothe his, quote unquote, tattered loving. And the tattered suggests both emotional vulnerability and an unworthy state. And so the speaker longs for a transformation where love, kind of once raw and exposed, is ultimately adorned or elevated, made, quote unquote, worthy in the beloved's eyes. So that is significant here. The final couplet, then may I dare to boast how I do love thee, till then not show my head where thou mayest prove me. Here we are provided with a conditional self-assertion. So only when the speaker feels worthy, when fate or the beloved's favor clothes his love and dignity, will he then, quote-unquote, boast or publicly proclaim it. And so until then, he stays hidden, not exposing himself to judgment, where we kind of see not show my head is where we kind of see that. And the phrase, quote-unquote, where thou mayest prove me, can in a sense imply testing. He isn't ready to be measured against the beloved standards yet. And so that was the ending of Sonnet 26. We'll move on to Sonnet 27. Weary with toll, I haste me to my bed. The dear repose for limbs with travel tired, but then begins a journey in my head to work my mind when body's work's expired. For then my thoughts from far where I abide intend a zealous pilgrimage to thee, and keep my drooping eyelids open wide, looking on darkness which the blind do see. Save that my soul's imaginary sight presents thy shadow to my sightless view, which like a jewel hung in ghastly night makes black night beauteous and her old face new. Lo, thus by day my limbs, by night my mind, for thee and for myself no quiet find. That was Sonnet 27, lines 1 and 2. Weary with toil, I haste me to my bed. The dear repose for limbs with travel tired. Now, we see how the two lines here establish the speaker's physical fatigue. The rhyming itself kind of slows a bit with the monosyllables, like haste me to my bed. We feel a dragging of a tired body. And also the phrase dear repose suggests that bed is not just rest, but is not just for rest, but is a deeply valued place, a sanctuary. And there's an implicit contrast building already here, where the body craves stillness, but rest is about to prove elusive. And so these two lines, although seeming kind of straightforward, can provoke or kind of elaborate and provide more in-depth thinking to the reader. Lines 3 and 4, but then begins a journey in my head to work my mind when body's work's expired. Now here we are provided with the first turn, and the phrase but, the word but, kind of marks a shift from expected rest to mental unrest. It's really cool to me how one word or just one little phrase can really shift meanings and shift thoughts in a poem or just any sort of writing. And I think Shakespeare does a brilliant job in that in the sonnets. And so the but here marks a shift from expected rest to mental unrest. And we see a paradox forming. So the paradox of while the body ceases its labor, the mind beginning its own. So the idea of a journey in my head, quote unquote, introduces the central metaphor in these two lines, where the mental is a pilgrimage born of longing. And so that is significant in lines 3 and 4. Moving on to lines 5 and 6, for then my thoughts from far where I abide intend a zealous pilgrimage to thee. And so the journey becomes a zealous pilgrimage, a religious and emotional undertaking, in other words. And so zealous here intensifies the devotion, where the speaker is not just daydreaming, and it's a sacred-driven longing. And the word intend suggests a deliberate focus of thought, while, quote-unquote, from far where I abide, re-emphasizes the separation. And so the contrasts here we can kind of see with the paradox from the previous two lines, where the body ceases the labor, but the mind begins its own. And so there's a separateness in the body here, which is interesting. Lines 7 and 8, and keep my drooping eyelids open wide, looking on darkness which the blind do see. And so here we see the pilgrimage disrupting sleep through drooping eyelids, how that kind of shows the speaker's fight against rest. And then comes the beautifully yet haunting simile, quote-unquote darkness, which the blind do see. And so it's obviously not an ordinary darkness. It's a very deep, imageless void. In a sense, a kind of blind vision. And so we see that the speaker here is suspended between the sensory deprivation and inner sight. And so a lot of contrasts within the human body in this poem here. Lines 9 to 10, save that my soul's imaginary sight presents thy shadow to my sightless view. Now we are here provided or given that the soul takes over as the perceiver. The imaginary sight of the soul, in a sense, compensates for physical blindness, which is, again, another paradox. And the shadow of the beloved appears, but not the actual person, but it's an inner version or memory, perhaps. And thy shadow here has a double meaning, where it means both a faint image and also a ghostly presence. And so here we see that love becomes spectral. So here is lines 9 and 10. Lines 11 to 12, which like a jewel hung in ghastly night, makes black night beauteous and her old face new. And so here we see that the lover's image transforms the night like a jewel, sparkling in a ghastly dark. It makes an even ugliness glow. And so the black night becomes beauteous and her old face new. So here we see that the line here anthropomorphizes night, giving her a bit of a rejuvenated beauty because of love's luminous presence. So a lot of contrasting and a lot of comparing and a lot of kind of metamorphizing, in a sense, of different aspects of human mental mental capabilities and mental emotions here. The final couplet, "Lo, thus by day my limbs, by night my mind, for thee and for myself no quiet find." Here we are provided with the poem's central tension, where there's no rest, and day is toil for the body, and night is toil for the soul. And this, all of this, is this cause is love, where the beloved thee and the speaker's own consuming desire plays a big role in this. This whole creation of the poem, and where love plays in as well. And so the final couplet, in a sense, pins the emotional cost, where that is the loss of peace. So that was Sonnet 27. A lot of analysis there, which was interesting and compelling. And we will move on to 28. But before we do, I have another song to play for you guys, again by Tess Anderson. I'm bringing back a lot of songs that I played in my previous episodes, but I mean, they're all brilliant songs, and so why not? But yeah, this one is called "Why Leave Me Alone" by Tess Anderson. So we'll give this one a listen to and then come back to read Sonnet 28. We'll be right back.
By now, you would have this all figured out, like you said you did, 'cause you said you did. Don't apologize, you've been here about a billion times. Had enough of this, yet you still persist. Shouldn't have to say it twice, boy. Little on each lonely night when you're calling me up, 'cause you're drinking too much. Just because I ain't so nice, boy, doesn't mean I'll be your vice. When I said no, once again, you said a little too much. I'm not into it. I'm still not into it. No, give me some respect. Can't you show a little intellect? I'm not getting down. No, I'm not kidding around. No, I don't owe you anything, boy. Nobody died and made you king, but you're calling me up, thinking tonight you'll have luck. Oh, many times. Why?
You just finished listening to Why, Leave Me Alone by Tess Anderson. So we will move on now to Sonnet 28. How can I then return in happy plight, that am debarred their benefit of rest, when day's oppression is not eased by night, but day by night and night by day oppressed? And each, though enemies to either's reign, do in consent shake hands to torture me, the one by toil, the other to complain, how far I toil still farther off from thee. I tell the day to please him thou art bright, and dost him grace when clouds do blot the heaven. So flatter I the swart complexion night, when sparkling stars twirl out, though gildest the even. But day doth daily draw my sorrows longer, and night doth nightly make grief's length seem stronger. So that was Sonnet 28, and it seems like it is a continuation of the restless longing explored in the previous Sonnet 27. So we will do some close reading here. Lines 1 and 2, how can I then return a happy flight that am debarred the benefit of rest? Now we are started off with a rhetorical question. The phrase happy plight, an oxymoron, so plight usually meaning trouble, may imply that the ideal or hoped for condition, but the speaker quickly states that he is debarred, forbidden, from the benefit of rest. And so we see that sleep again here is inaccessible, and restlessness is the premise. Lines 3 and 4. When day's oppression is not eased by night, but day by night and night by day oppressed. Now this couplet here brings in a paradox. Both day and night are equally oppressive, and the mirroring of day by night and day by day emphasizes the reversal. And so things that are normally opposites, they become allies in affliction. And so I could see that Shakespeare here, in a sense, turns the natural order into a torment cycle. So that was lines 3 and 4. Lines 5 and 6, in each, though enemies to either's reign, do in consent shake hands to torture me. Now, the image here is strong, where the quote-unquote enemies, which is implied day and night, should naturally oppose one another. Yet, they also, quote-unquote, shake hands, and they conspire. So, the metaphor of rulers, reign, adds a political, almost tyrannical weight to the personification. And we can see that time itself is imagined as a torturous regime. Moving on to lines 7 and 8. The one by toil, the other to complain, how far I toil still farther off from thee. So we see that the torment is divided. Day inflicts labor, toil, and night becomes a space for mental suffering. And so the final line here is very subtle, but brutal. And the more the speaker toils, the farther he will feel, the farther he feels from the beloved. And so we are given a small lesson in the lines 7 and 8, where effort only will increase distance. And so it's an irony. Lines 9 and 10, I tell the day to please him thou art bright, and dost him grace when clouds do blot the heaven. So here, the speaker tries to flatter day, and he personifies the flattering day as someone who can't be pleased. And so he tells a day that the beloved is bright and lends his lover's qualities to the sky. And so we see a sense of desperation here, trying to soothe the oppressor by invoking the beloved's radiance. Lines 11 to 12. So flatter I the swart complexioned night when sparkling stars twire not, thou gildest the evening. So the night here becomes swart, which is dark complexioned, and the speaker again kind of flatters it. And twire, which means to twinkle, when the stars are absent, the speaker imagines the beloved as the one who gilds, so beautifies with gold the evening. And so it's a very pretty, gorgeous image where even without the stars, the beloved lights the darkness. So we see a bit of a positive analysis with the speaker. The final couplet is, again, a bit of a repetition, but day doth daily and night doth nightly. Now, the speaker is using sound. Shakespeare is using sound to emphasize routine and the unrelenting grief, where the time will not pass. Time doesn't pass. It actually stretches sorrow. And so we could kind of see that the line lengths themselves almost feel stretched, which mimics emotional weight. And so that's kind of significant in this aspect. And that was Sonnet 28. We'll move on to Sonnet 29. When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my hate. Fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy contended least. Yet in these thoughts myself almost despising, haply I think on thee and then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising, from sullen earth sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings, that then I scorn to change my state with kings. We are here. We see a bit of isolation and despair in the lines 1 to 4, where the lines kind of open up with a moment of deep alienation. And so the speaker feels abandoned by both fortune and men's eyes. Fortune implies luck, and men's eyes will imply social approval or recognition. And the quote-unquote disgrace signals both personal shame and public failure, and the repetition of isolation is intense also, where we see, quote-unquote, I all alone beweep my outcast state. And here the use of beweep is, in a sense, both dramatic and pitiful, where it emphasizes the speaker's raw emotional state, literally crying over his own alienation. The bootless cries kind of captures the futility of his suffering, where his prayers or laments fall on deaf heaven, suggesting divine indifference. Lines 5 to 8, envy and self-comparison. Here the speaker kind of spirals into envy. The repetition in like him underscores the intensity of this self-erasure. And the syntax also gets kind of crowded, where by the time we reach with what I most enjoy contended least, it's clear that he has lost touch even with his own joys. And so we see that his self-worth has collapsed under the weight of comparison. Again, very relevant to the modern era right now as well. Lines 9 to 12, we see a volta here. Happily I think on thee, a very quiet kind of accidental, happily meaning by chance, and it's as if the thought of the beloved drifts in like through a crack. And so the lark here suggests spiritual elevation, joy, and rebirth, and the earlier deaf heaven is now open to song. So that's significant here. And so The final couplet is a revaluation of the self, where we see it's a reversal as well, and the speaker who once envied everything now would not trade places with a king. Thy sweet love remembered, that phrase acts like a talisman, bringing not just comfort, but a feeling of immense inner wealth, enough to counter every previous grievance. So we see a lot of, it starts off somewhere, and then the speaker kind of ends up this somewhere else. But it's usually how the speaker usually learns something and engages with it, and then overcomes these struggles. And we see that explicitly through this poem. I do think Sonnet 30 is going to be our max for today, which is fine. So we'll give this one a read, Sonnet 30. When to the sessions of sweet silent thought, I summon up remembrance of things past. I sigh the lack of many thing I thought, of many a thing I sought, and with old wows new wail my dear times waste. Then can I drown an eye unused to flow for precious friends hidden depths, dateless night, and weep afresh love's long since cancelled woe, and moan the expense of many a vanished sight. Then can I grieve at grievances foregone, and heavily from woe to woe tell over the sad account of four bemoaned moan, which I knew pay as if not paid before. But if the while I think on thee, dear friend, all losses are restored and sorrows end. Moving on to lines 1 and 2. Now we are opened with a metaphor. Memory is seen as a session, which evokes the image of a solemn court or introspective meditation. And the phrase, sweet silent thought, here suggests a quiet, solitary, and almost pleasurable kind of reflection. I mean, though the sweetness soon turns bittersweet, we see that. The phrase summon up gives the memory of an almost magical or judicial quality, like calling witnesses or spirits into presence. And so that's interesting in lines 1 and 2. Lines 3 and 4, I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes new wail my dear time's waste. We kind of shift quickly into regret. The sighing indicates longing and unfulfilled desires, things once thought are now lost. And the phrase old woes new wail captures a paradox. Grieves from the past are relived in the present. Time has passed, but the pain lingers and can be reactivated. And quote-unquote, dear times waste. This phrase underscores the preciousness of lost time, both a lament and an accusation. Lines 5 and 6. Then can I drown an eye unused to flow for precious friends hidden death's dateless night. Now here, this image of weeping, where we read drown an eye, in a sense reveals an emotional flood that was once held back, unused to flow, quote-unquote. This phrase, or phrases, they're powerful because it suggests a restraint breaking down. Death's dateless night, quote-unquote, is a striking phrase as well, where we see death as a timeless, eternal darkness. Lines 7 and 8. And weep afresh love's long since cancelled woe, and moan the expense of many a vanished sight. And so weep afresh, the phrase weep afresh, kind of echoes the old woe's new wail from before, and emphasizes how past pain can be as vivid as ever. The phrase love's long since cancelled woe refers to old heartbreaks, formally ended, but but very still emotionally potent. The phrase "expense of many a vanished sight" can suggest not only emotional cost, but I think it's not only about that. I think it also suggests a visual memory where people and moments that were once seen and are now gone, possibly even deliberately forgotten, but they're still remembered, and in this case, painfully. Lines 9 to 12, "Then can I grieve at grievances foregone, and heavenly from woe to woe tell over, the sad account of four bemoaned moan, which I knew pay as if not paid before." So we see a climax, or the strongest point of sorrow here. We could see this as an emotional audit, a tallying up of quote-unquote grievances foregone. The phrase "sad account" continues the metaphor of finance, of expense and pay, and it reinforces the idea that emotional pain is like a debt being repeatedly settled but never being resolved. And so we see the significance here as well with the phrase "four bemoaned moan" and the idea of a new paying that was added. And it already paid grief highlights. The grief highlights the futility and repetition of mourning. And so a lot of comparisons to the financial aspects. And it reminds me of Sisyphus, Rolling Stone. I don't know, I just wanted to say that. It reminds me of that. Like, the speaker relives his grief endlessly. Through the lines 9 to 12, it reminds me of that. Which is also... I don't know if Shakespeare was influenced by that when he was reading this line, but it seems the whole idea seems similar to the Rolling Stone from Sisyphus. Moving on to the final couplet, "But if the while I think on thee, dear friend, all losses are restored and sorrows end." Now this is the volta, and again, like how I mentioned before, how the overcoming happens and the realization happens, the poem kind of takes a sharp turn and introduces a redemptive presence. And so the quote-unquote dear friend becomes a restorative figure who undergoes an accumulative sorrow. And so this friend might be a literal companion, a lost beloved, or just a muse-like ideal, depending on the interpretations of others. And the line, "all losses are restored," is miraculous. It brings in a miraculous force, and as if it kind of emphasizes as if memory can, it brings into play where a memory can relive the dead and heal the deepest wounds. And so that was Sonnet 31 for you guys. We have already ended and gone through the whole episode. I don't know, it went by kind of fast today, but we went through Sonnets 26 to 30, and so we will end off the episode there for today. I'm having a blast with this, and so again, I keep mentioning, if you guys have any other suggestions with different readings, let me know, and we will end off today's episode there. I hope you guys have a fabulous rest of your week. My next episode will be on the Saturday 19th at 8 p.m. So if you guys want to tune in then, tune in. And that'll be the end. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your day, wonderful rest of your week. And I will see you guys again on the 19th at 8 p.m. Thank you all so much. Bye-bye.
Out on the river where I go with my friends, they push cars off the banks, I take pictures where they lay.